This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take on the slants of the media and the propaganda that's been coming out justifying the undeclared American war against that country. We speak with anti-war activist Brian Becker, who recently wrote an important article called "The Truth About the Situation in Libya, Cutting Through the Government Propaganda and Media Lies."
We talk with one of the producers of the new film, Better This World. It's a gripping story of two childhood friends who travel to the 2000 RNC in Minnesota. This is a finely detailed account of the U.S. government's abuse of authority and the impact on many lives. Stay with us.
City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Libya, a country of 6 million people, possesses the largest of Africa's oil resources, and its oil is of a particularly high quality. Since March 19th of this year, the air forces of Britain, France, and NATO, as well as CIA Predator drone aeroplanes, have conducted nearly 7,500 bombing attacks on Libya. Meanwhile, ground forces made up of special operations and commando units of NATO led and direct the military operations there. In his recent article titled "The Truth About the Situation in Libya, Cutting Through the Government Propaganda and Media Lies," Answer Coalition National Coordinator Brian Becker lays out the history and facts about the ongoing Libyan invasion. He joins us today to talk more about the unfolding events in Libya. Brian Becker has been a central organizer of many of the anti-war demonstrations in Washington, D.C. Brian Becker, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Brian, I was listening to Al Jazeera early this morning, and they seem to think here on August 24th, Gaddafi is surrounded, his regime is on its last legs. I read a long article about the evaluation that Juan Cole has made of it, and I think he seems to speak for a lot of people, particularly liberally minded people, that the NATO intervention and the American Obama support for it was good, that this is a popular revolt. It's really an outgrowth of the Arab Spring. The Libyan people are going to be left better off as a consequence of the removal of the Gaddafi regime. Leave aside the question about whether or not the United States should be at war with anybody. Let me ask you, what is your take on those people who say that this intervention by the United States is going to lead to a better situation for the Libyan people?
Well, I think that there is a substantial number of people, sadly, unfortunately, who have been accommodated themselves to the full-scale demonization of the targeted government, in this case, the government of Gaddafi in Libya, targeted comprehensively in the media by the corporate-sponsored media in the United States, in Britain, in France, with Al Jazeera, in Qatar, and also by some liberal media outlets as well. The United States, the British, the French, the former colonizers and enslavers of Africa, always assign their bombing missions, their interventions, their invasions, a noble cause. They never, for instance, say, we're going in to exploit Libya's oil or Iraq's oil. We're not going in to bring back U.S. and British military bases that once occupied Libya until Gaddafi came to power. They're never going to say that their motives are anything but pure. And so they assigned this mission, the noble cause of protecting civilians, and then characterized the targeted government, in this case Gaddafi, as having threatened a full-scale massacre in Benghazi. There was no proof offered of that. And I think that we know now from the recent invasions in Iraq and Afghanistan, the continuing war against the Palestinians, and this new war against Libya, that the propaganda campaign is always part of the overall war effort. There's a propaganda effort to demonize the targeted country. And sadly, and not unusually, though, a good part of liberal public opinion in the United States accommodates itself to that. Let's just look at what the real situation is. Gaddafi came to power in 1969. He immediately evicted the Wheelis Air Force Base and the two British Air Force bases that were the dominant powers inside of Libya. That happened in 1970. The National Transition Council, that group that is fighting Gaddafi and is sponsored by NATO, their first act when they formed as a government in process of coming into being was to invite those same powers to begin bombing their country, to begin funding and financing their operation. You can see that on one side, you have the Gaddafi government, in spite of all of its contradictions, came into being as an expression of the anti-colonial sentiment that existed in Libya in 1969 and 1970, and that was sweeping the Middle East. And this new group, the National Transition Council, is the antithesis of anti-colonialism. It is sponsored by those same colonial powers. Libya has the largest oil reserves in all of Africa. It has a particularly high grade of oil. It's a prize. It's a prize for ExxonMobil, for ConocoPhillips, Chevron. It has been a prize for a long time.
But, Brian, isn't it true that the oil companies in the West, and Britain and France and Italy and the United States, have had contracts with Libyan oil? They're doing business as usual with the Libyan government with respect to the oil. So is this really a war about oil?
Well, it's not just about oil. I mean, let's, again, look at the history. Yes, they had contracts. They, in 2004, after the invasion of Iraq and the destruction of the Ba'athist government there, George W. Bush and the European powers ended the sanctions on Libya. And Libya attempted to accommodate itself to the Western powers. And they allowed the Western oil companies to come in, and they came in and they started doing business. During that time, of course, they were starting to become very unhappy with Gaddafi, accusing him, as we know from WikiLeaks released State Department cables, of, quote, resource nationalism, meaning that Gaddafi wasn't functioning as a complete puppet.
You mean he was playing ball, but not enough ball.
Right. He was a player, but they don't want partners. They want puppets, as we know and can see from the Gulf states where you have Saudi Arabia and Kuwait that function basically as part of an American or British previously sphere of influence. And so he let the companies come in, but he kept irritating them, annoying them, and the State Department cables reflect this. He even, because they refused to give Libya more of the deal, they're exploiting Libya so extensively in the last few years, and Gaddafi is complaining, and his complaints become louder and louder. He even threatened in 2009 to renationalize the contracts with Western oil companies. Now, if there had been no armed revolt in February of this year, the Western oil companies and the Western governments would have been content, although annoyed, to continue to do business with Gaddafi. But when the armed revolt began, and it was an armed revolt from the beginning with disaffected elements of the Libyan establishment, who immediately sought sponsorship from Western countries, then and only then was it clear to those Western NATO powers, Britain, France, and the United States, that not only could they be in Libya, but they had the possibility of being in Libya without Gaddafi at all, without any annoying semi-nationalist or nationalist entity, and that they could use these other human beings, the National Transition Council, as their vessel. In other words, they saw in the armed revolt an opportunity to carry out that which they had wanted to do for 40 years, which is to get rid of the Gaddafi government altogether and replace it with a proxy or client regime.
So what kind of popular support does the National Transition Council have? There are masses of people out on the street. It seems that there's a lot of discontent with the Gaddafi government. How do you gauge that?
Well, I think the National Transition Council has a big base of support in Benghazi, in the eastern part of the country, which is also a very oil-rich region, which had its regional impact in terms of Libya's body politic somewhat diminished after the 1969 revolution. The former king, the pro-Western king, King Idris, was from Benghazi. The 1969-1970 revolution shifted power not only to more radical nationalist forces, but also geographically and regionally away from Benghazi. So there could be, and there are, regional differences, regional disputes. In Benghazi, the National Transition Council clearly has a base. In Tripoli, in the capital, it's been quite clear that the Gaddafi government also has a very large base of support. It doesn't have the entire country's support. There's no question about that. But in the recent weeks, in the last months, we've seen demonstrations of hundreds of thousands of Libyans, maybe as many as a million, gathering in Green Square against the bombing of Tripoli. Now, not all of them were Gaddafi supporters. Many of them, perhaps majority of them, were in something of a united front with the Gaddafi government against the bombing of their city by foreign powers. But they nonetheless were standing with the government. Now, in the last days, there's been a psychological war conducted to overthrow the government in Tripoli. What we don't see is the fact that NATO has carried out 7,500 bombing missions in the recent months, many of them against military formations of the Gaddafi government, many against civilian and communication centers, and they have been wearing down the defenses inside of Tripoli and the morale of the people, possibly. If you lived in Tripoli right now, and if you had been subjected to 6 months of bombing by the most powerful governments in the world, and you thought that the only way for this to end would be for the overthrow of the government that they had targeted, one might waver in terms of their support for that government. We've seen this phenomenon also happen. In other words, even those who may have supported Gaddafi may also feel there's no way out of the imperialist assault except for the transfer of power. We saw that, for instance, in Nicaragua. The eight-year-long war against the Sandinistas in the 1980s, tens of thousands of Nicaraguans died. It was clear that there was going to be no let-up. And finally, the Sandinistas lost that election in 1988. In other words, it's a profound pressure on a population when they're bombed, when they're sanctioned, when they're deprived of that which is necessary to sustain life. But I would say both sides have a base. The issue, a base within the country, but the issue for us in the United States is to look at the motives of the U.S., the British, and the French. Are they really coming in to Libya because they care about democracy or freedom or against dictatorship? I mean, why don't they start bombing Saudi Arabia? There's no elections in Saudi Arabia. Women can't drive cars in Saudi Arabia. The punishment for women committing adultery is stoning to death. There's no protests in Saudi Arabia because they're met with imprisonment, torture, and execution. And yet there's no bombing of Saudi Arabia. Why? Because the Saudi government functions as a proxy puppet client regime of the United States. And that's what they held against Gaddafi. He was willing to partner with them in the recent years, but still not a complete puppet.
Talk to us, Brian Becker, about the social benefits that people in Libya, there's only a population of about 6 million with all that rich oil. When Gaddafi came to power, what kind of things did he do with respect to, say, health and education?
Yes, it's an important thing because if you read the U.S. media and watch the TV, you would think there's been this 40 years of dark, grim dictatorship with nothing good happened during these whole 40 years. Just the nightmare is finally ending. Well, even if you don't agree with Gaddafi, you'd have to look at the social programs that Gaddafi instituted after 1969 and say that they were very progressive and that they expanded the opportunities and lives and living conditions of the Libyan people. There was mass illiteracy in 1969. Today, 92% of the people are literate. They developed the most expansive social insurance program in Africa. The per capita income in Libya is the highest in Africa. It's $14,000 a year. Education was free. Health care was free. The life expectancy of Libyans today is 77 years old. Now, that's coming from a country that was considered one of the poorest in all of Africa and in all of the world prior to the 1960s. A massive expansion of living standards and living conditions for the Libyan people. Now today, a highly, highly educated and well-cared-for population. Those were the consequences of the policy adopted by Gaddafi. So even with the recent years where they've adopted they've accommodated themselves to neoliberalism, the foundational growth of Libya was based on these programs adopted in the 1970s and 1980s.
Brian, the United States, although it is supporting the war there and is actually having the CIA fly Predator drone assassination planes, but the Congress has never declared war against Libya. And Reid, the head of the Democratic Party in the Senate, said, well, this war is going to be over so quickly we don't have to declare war. But the Constitution of the United States says quite clearly that Congress must declare war. Nonetheless, they're going about supporting the overthrow, a regime change is what Obama articulated, without doing that. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution makes it clear that only Congress has the right to declare war. This is clearly a war when you drop thousands of bombs and missiles. And the Americans are doing most of the bombing, by the way. It's not simply, quote, leading from behind. That's partly public relations by the Obama administration. The bulk of the sorties are carried out by American aircraft. Very few voices in Congress. Dennis Kucinich was one, clearly, who made the point and has demanded that the Obama administration be held accountable for what is basically a violation of the Constitution. Obama even went beyond what George W. Bush did in one sense. In Iraq, Bush demanded and got from Congress something of a blank check for later military operations. That was the vote in October 2002. In the case of Libya, the Obama administration said, well, we don't even have to introduce any legislation that would give us any kind of pretext or premise for engaged in military hostilities, because they said that the bombing of Libya doesn't, quote, constitute a hostility in the traditional sense in which the word hostility is meant. I mean, that's real, true doublespeak. You know, I think a lot of people don't realize the extent to which that this is not simply NATO supporting a rebel force, but the entire operation is a NATO operation. The Guardian newspaper on August 23rd says, for instance, and I'll quote you, British and NATO military commanders are planning what they hope will be the final onslaught on Colonel Gaddafi's forces to put an end to all resistance from troops loyal to the Libyan leader. And then they go on and describe, and this has come out only in the recent days, how French and British, and in particular British commando units, have actually been leading the troops into battle, giving the advice, yes, but also leading them into battle and coordinating with the U.S., the British, and the French Air Force for pinpoint, precise military bombing campaigns against Libyan resistance forces. And so leading from behind is just more euphemistic language to designed to conceal what is, one, an illegal war, as you suggest, or certainly as I would assert, because it has no authorization. Certainly the Security Council isn't a legal entity that gives the United States executive the authority to carry out wars of aggression. But it's not simply supporting people in the field who have a beef or a grievance or are in armed struggle against Gaddafi. If it was them and them alone, they would never have succeeded to the extent that they are succeeding. This is the military efforts by the Pentagon and their colleagues in Britain and France to overthrow an independent government, and they're using disaffected Libyans as foot soldiers in this battle.
I would add that the United States, when it was formed, when the Declaration of Independence was issued in 1776, it was issued on the basis that the people in this country had a right to determine for themselves what kind of government they had. Whether you agree or disagree with the Gaddafi government, that would be, I would say, the business of the Libyan people, not the American government. And the principle of self-determination, which was a great principle that was established in the American Revolution 200-some years ago, is what's being violated there now. Wouldn't you agree?
I would, and I think that we should, you know, political people need to recognize that the last century has been the the era of imperialism. The slogan of self-determination has no credibility except in that struggle against imperialism. in World War One, in the case of the Middle East, when that war was coming to an end, there was a secret treaty signed called the Sykes-Picot Treaty between the British, the French, and Tsarist Russia. When the Bolshevik Revolution succeeded in 1917, Lenin and the Bolsheviks renounced secret treaties and they made it public. But what that treaty showed is that in spite of all of the utterances about self-determination at that time by Woodrow Wilson and the other Western leaders, that these imperial powers were secretly dividing the spoils of war, meaning in this case the people of the Middle East, the Arab people, dividing it amongst themselves, saying Britain will get Egypt and France will get Lebanon and this one will get this country. In other words, dividing the Middle East amongst themselves, making a mockery out of the idea of self-determination. And you can bet, Michael, that and as we know, in fact, and as all these news reports will come out slowly in the next couple of days, there are also secret arrangements today between the victors, should they succeed in Libya, between the British, the French, and the United States about how to divide Libya's vast oil resources amongst themselves. Who will get what? Who will get control of certain oil fields? Who will get control of the banking sector? And so we have on one side self-determination, a noble slogan and something all of us should embrace authentically. And on the other side, you have imperial powers who, for their own crude, material, national, and I would say capitalist interests, are waging war against this poor, small country, but a country with a lot of oil, not to bring freedom, not to support self-determination, but to divide up the markets just as they did in World War One with the Sykes-Picot Treaty.
Brian Becker, I wanted to ask you what you think the implications of American and NATO policy in Libya are for countries that the United States looks at as hostile governments, like the governments, say, of Venezuela or Bolivia.
Well, I think you have asked a vital question, and I think every progressive person in the United States must recognize that if this operation in Libya succeeds, the use of foreign military forces and intelligence forces and drone aircraft and military operations, coupled with the oppositional movements in Libya, for instance, the same tactics will be applied in other countries that have been deemed to be too independent of the dictates of Washington. They will be used to try to overthrow. It will embolden the phenomena of so-called regime change in Syria, very importantly and most directly, I think, this will be the case. It will also be used to embolden those same forces who want to overthrow the government of Chavez in Venezuela, Morales in Bolivia, of course, the Cuban government, which has been targeted and with the same colorful, demonizing language employed against the Libyans for the past 50 years because they, too, became independent. I think this is a critical moment, and sadly, and I think this is really something everybody has to take into account, because it's a Democrat, because it's the Obama administration who's carrying out this war of aggression using all of these complicated economic and military strategies to destabilize Libya and try to carry out regime change. Because it's Obama and not Bush, because it's the Democrats and not the Republicans, too many progressive anti-war, normally active people are sitting on the sidelines watching, wondering, rather than being fully active in building the kind of militant anti-war movement in the United States that says to the people of the world, we recognize that this government that does this in our name, with our budget, with the blood of our young people, does it without our consent, and we, the people of the United States, will stand with you against empire and in solidarity with those who actually want to have self-determination. So I think we're at a kind of a critical crossroads for the progressive and anti-war movement. We in the Answer Coalition and others have stood up as vigorously as possible in the recent months against the Libyan campaign. Unfortunately, some of the people we've seen in the earlier anti-war movement have been on the sidelines. That situation has to change.
Brian Becker, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having us.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs, and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Lobau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more.
In recent shows, we've taken up several issues involving the FBI's targeting of protesters, overzealous prosecutors, and their collective impact on domestic dissent. These topics are just part of a riveting story in the documentary titled Better This World, directed and produced by Katie Galloway and Kelly Duane de la Vega, produced also by Mike Nicholson. The film is a story of two boyhood friends from Texas who travel to the 2008 Republican National Convention in Minnesota and find themselves embroiled in an FBI case involving multiple domestic terrorism counts. Better This World gets right to the heart of the so-called War on Terror, its impact on civil liberties, and protest activities. One review described the film as, quote, riveting. Structured like a taut thriller, it delivers a chilling depiction of loyalty, naivete, political zealotry, and the post-9/11 security state. And it features one doozy of a kicker in the Where Are They Now category. We're joined today by one of the film's producers, Katie Galloway. She's an award-winning filmmaker and has taught documentary production at the Columbia Journalism School. She now teaches media studies at UC Berkeley. Welcome, Katie, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I've had the privilege of seeing Better This World, and I've got to say, it's one of the best films that I've seen. Perhaps I'm biased because I was at the RNC in 2008, but I felt like I was back there. Before we get into some of the specifics, can you tell us how you got involved in this film in the first place?
Sure. It was early 2009, and we saw a headline in the New York Times about the arrest of two young activists at the Republican National Convention. I didn't hear about the story until David McKay, one of the young men, was going to trial. His co-defendant, Bradley Crowder, had taken a plea. That's what most people do in the federal system, for sure. But David had decided to roll the dice and was going to federal trial, and he was alleging that he had been entrapped. So, like many of your listeners, I imagine, I had noticed a sort of pattern of cases after 9/11 where there had been domestic terrorism charges and then a counter-allegation of government misconduct or entrapment. And I thought this was, well, Kelly and I thought this was a great opportunity to look behind the headlines and see what was really going on in one of these cases.
Why did the government focus specifically on Brad and David? And I guess we should know, how long before the RNC had they been interested in them?
David and Brad went to an informational meeting in Austin, Texas, which is where they were living at the time, about protesting at the Republican National Convention. There was a group called the RNC Welcoming Committee, which was a anarchist collective out of Minneapolis who was touring the country and recruiting people to come and protest the convention. David and Brad did not know that they wanted to go to the convention for sure. They were really just sort of curious. When they went to that meeting, they were approached by a very well-known, well-respected activist named Brandon Darby, who had sort of gained some measure of fame after Hurricane Katrina and had done a lot of great work and co-founded an organization called Common Ground that fed and housed a lot of people. He approached David and Brad at the meeting, and he said that he thought that they should think about working together. And David and Brad were really excited about this because they thought this is a guy with real credibility who's done a lot of amazing work, and it might be an opportunity for them to learn about activism and protest. So they spent time with Brandon over the next 6 months between early 2008 and the convention. During that time, the government was also watching David and Brad. The Twin Cities, which is where the RNC was in 2008, had been designated a homeland security site. And so for 2 years leading up to the convention, multiple law enforcement and federal agencies had been involved in proactive investigations, among other things, of activist groups who might be coming to the RNC. So David and Brad, by virtue of coming to this meeting, raised the suspicion of the government. But they were sort of had people, informants, and investigators out far and wide around the country well before the RNC.
Let's tell our listeners, Brad and David are relatively young. They were in their early 20s when they went to the RNC, correct?
Right.
And they weren't sort of veteran activists. This was one of their first forays into protest.
Absolutely. Brad had been politicized as a teenager by the shock and awe campaign. Really, he was shocked and awed by what he saw on television. He was living in Midland at the time, and he felt that this was wrong, and he did what was a pretty dramatic move for Midland, Texas. He drew a upside-down American flag on his T-shirt and wore it to school the next day and got sent home, and it became a sort of dramatic event in town. And so he had been sort of politically conscious and awakened as a teenager, but hadn't really participated in formal protest activities. David really was giving Brad a ride to the meeting at the bookstore because Brad didn't have a car, and David had very little to no background in activism. So this is going to be their first major act.
And I must say that the RNC for first-time protesters is really kind of a dramatic introduction. Jeff, our producer, and I went there. It was really like a police state there. A very intimidating presence of all types of law enforcement from all around the country, including the military. So Brad and David get to the RNC, and I don't want to give away a lot of the film because it is really like a tight thriller in a way, as well as being a really fine sort of documentary of what happened. But they were arrested with terrorism charges. Can you give a brief overview of that?
David and Brad had been working over the 6 months leading up to the convention to prepare for protests in the streets. Their sort of big contribution was making shields that they planned to use to protect other protesters who were locked down or blocking streets and that sort of thing from rubber bullets and tear gas. That was their hope. So they made a bunch of shields, over 30 shields, and had brought them up in a U-Haul trailer with the activists they traveled with. That was their plan. When they got to the Twin Cities, as you said, they were completely stunned by the police presence. I mean, they did not expect to see what they found. It was just overwhelming, and everybody was being stopped and searched, and they had all of their shields taken. They were followed when they first got into Minneapolis, pulled over at gunpoint. The police said they made a mistake and let them go, but it was a very paranoid environment. And then they parked their U-Haul trailer, and when they came back, several hours later, the whole trailer had been emptied, the shields, all of their personal belongings, and there hadn't been a search warrant, and nothing illegal had happened at that point. So they felt shocked and violated by that experience, and I think it was a constellation of factors that led to their going to a Walmart and deciding to buy the materials to make Molotov cocktails. They decided after making them that they weren't going to use them. They woke up the next morning and said, we're not prepared to do this, and they stashed them in the basement where they stayed for several days. But then they were arrested. They were arrested after information was given from within their circle, and they were accused of domestic terrorism.
Now, how did their families react to the arrest and subsequent events? Because in the film, the families are interviewed a lot, and I was quite impressed, really, at how progressive and supportive the families were. Were they supportive?
Well, the families both love their sons, cousins, you know, nephews. I mean, there is a lot of love in both families for these two guys. But they were completely shocked. I mean, David's family didn't even know he was going to the convention. Brad had promised his mom that he absolutely wouldn't get picked up for anything. He was just going to protest. So it was a shock to them. And they weren't really able to talk openly with their families on the phone, because as you see in the film, or as you hear in the film, when you hear the jailhouse phone calls between David and his family, they're really stifled by being monitored. All the calls are obviously monitored. And so they were not able to tell their families what happened. And so their families remained just mystified about how this happened, how these people they thought they knew could wind up making Molotov cocktails and being charged with domestic terrorism.
How has the friendship between Brad and David changed since the arrests?
I think the friendship has really been through it. I mean, it's also a coming-of-age story about these two young men who are best friends and have known each other since childhood. And ultimately, I think, and I don't, again, want to give away too much, but it's a story about friendship and loyalty against the backdrop of the post-9/11 domestic security apparatus with the full weight of the state on these guys and trying to turn them against each other. And so they definitely go through it, and as we see in the film. Ultimately, I think they come through the other side not feeling betrayed, but rather feeling like their friendship has withstood the ultimate test. Well, it's been complicated, and they're going to have a lot to talk about once David finally gets off parole in however many years. I think it's 4 years out or something before they're legally allowed to talk to each other. They're still going to have things to hash out. They have a lot of love for each other, and where they had moments of feeling minor sort of betrayals by the other, ultimately they both feel like they were betrayed by the government, and that they stood by each other, and that they love and respect each other still.
And in fact, I think what you just said is so true, that this movie tells many stories. One of that is about our criminal justice system. What did you and Kelly Duane de la Vega, who also produced this with you, and Mike Nicholson, what did you learn about our criminal justice system?
Well, I actually had done a number of films on the criminal justice system. That's really my beat as a filmmaker. So I had learned quite a few things in looking at the war on drugs and the use of informants in the drug war. But what I think I learned, and Kelly learned also, is that the war on terror is really largely an extension or a continuation of the war on drugs. The rampant but increased use of informants in the war on terror, the tendency for people in the federal system to take pleas. Almost nobody goes to trial because the odds are so long. A very conservative estimate is 90% plus conviction rate in the federal system. So the norm is to take a plea, to give information, you know, to, quote, cooperate. And we also learned that in the United States, the sentences are so much longer than other Western industrialized countries, at least for comparable crimes. So people who see the film and see that David, who built Molotov cocktails but didn't use them, was facing 30 years, that's shocking. We had actually a woman in the audience from Greece at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, and she said, you know, someone throws a Molotov cocktail at every protest. It's just sort of, that's what we do. And I don't know if that's accurate, but she was blown away by the idea that this, he hadn't actually even taken them out of that house, and he was looking at 30 years. And I think that's true with many different sorts of crimes across the board, that our sentences are 5 to 12 times longer than other countries for comparable crimes. And I also think we get a real strong sense in this story of the collateral damage of federal prosecutions, of what it puts the families through, because in this incredibly politically charged adversarial system, the tendency is always to absolutely demonize the defense. You know, it becomes a caricature. And I think David says in our film, both sides are lying. Like, there's no room for gray here. It's a death battle. And so the intention is to really demonize defendants and make them look as bad as possible. I think he felt that way about the media as well. So he felt like it was a caricature of the truth, which is much more gray.
Katie, we're going to actually share a clip from the film. Could you set this up for our listeners?
Brad is at Sherburne County Jail in Minnesota, and he's talking to his attorney, federal defender Andrew Mooring, about why people tend to take plea bargains rather than going to trial.
Great. Let's take a listen.
Under the federal sentencing guidelines, there's a built-in punishment for going to trial. That's how it is. The system's built that way. The rules are written that way.
You go to trial, you're looking at 10 to 12 years. You take a plea deal, you're looking at 2.5. I mean, that's game theory. What are you going to do? The prosecution has unbelievable amounts of power in the negotiation process to make sure people don't go to trial. They don't like it's playing games. They don't like to have games played with them. That's what people consider going to trial. Exercising your right is playing games in the federal system. It's like going to trial is you're a liar and you don't want to take responsibility and I can't believe this. When what you want to do is like lay out all the evidence and say, look, this is the whole story. This is what actually happened. If I am guilty, then convict me, but don't bank me. Don't, you know, give me, you know, dozens of years more just because I wanted to have the full story laid out.
The details and nuances of informant involvement in cases often don't come to light because of the way that the law allows the government to keep that stuff secret. In some ways, this is just more of the same. The FBI's involvement in the anti-war movement and civil rights movements of the 1960s.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's important for people to be able to question the role of informants in these circumstances. You know, I mean, how is the government using informants? What role do they play in our society and our justice system? That's more interesting to me is not just the informant, but the government's role in how they use these informants.
And that was a clip from Better This World. We're talking with one of the producers, Katie Galloway. Katie, what has the response from audiences been to the film?
The response at film festivals we've been to, and we just opened theatrically recently in New York, has been incredible. I mean, one of our highest hopes for this film, because we made the choice to tell it so close to the bone and really tell these guys' story, which means that we don't use talking heads who are experts on the issue. And that's a trade-off. I think it was the right choice for this film. But we want to make sure that this film becomes a part of the larger national dialogue about life after 9/11, about the legal system, about sort of the expansion of the use of terrorism, the term, the legal term, the political term, and how that's changed life in the United States. And that's really, those are the sorts of conversations that are happening. People are really interested in hearing more about these guys and their case, but people have also been very interested in discussing and debating sort of where personal responsibility ends and government accountability begins, or the tensions between civil liberties and security. And so that's been incredibly gratifying to see it move out into the public sphere and be a part of this bigger and crucially important conversation.
I also really like how the film humanizes Brad and David and their families, their relationships, that, you know, complicated decisions, whether to take pleas, whether to go to trial. And I think that in all the jargon and rhetoric that the government spews forth about domestic terrorism, that humanity is so often lost. And this really helps counter that in an important way.
Thank you. That means a lot.
Well,
you know, the National Lawyers Guild, one of our large agendas is defending protesters. And so I really, as I mentioned earlier, felt that I was back there at the RNC. Your use of footage was just phenomenal. You must have poured through, I can't even imagine how much footage from the RNC. How did you get that?
Well, so when we went to Minneapolis initially, we thought we would follow the trial and the legal cases as they unfolded. And our normal style of filmmaking is verite, sort of letting things play out before the camera. But we quickly realized that the heart of the story was sort of what had happened in the 6 months leading up to the convention. And then we went about collecting archival footage. We got, largely because it went to trial, so we were lucky that way, a lot became part of the case. And so we had access to phone calls, to FBI interrogations, to a lot of surveillance photos and video. And then we also, there were a lot of activist protesters, filmmakers who had done a lot of filming themselves, and we got in touch with them and culled through many, many hours of street footage. And we also were able to get access to a lot of surveillance video because the Department of Homeland Security had given the Twin Cities over $1 million just for security cameras. So there were literally thousands of hours of footage all around the Twin Cities during the RNC, and we went through hundreds of hours to find our characters on the streets in various locations. So, yeah, painstaking process, but in the end, it really paid off because I do think it brings you there.
Definitely, I felt like I was back there. And just a final thought, I think the timing of the release is wonderful because we're a year in advance of the 2012 Republican convention. As you say, the government starts ramping up its security and its preparations a good 2 years in advance. So we're right getting into sort of the final stretch, as it were. And I think that will resonate with viewers around the country.
I think so, too. I mean, we have been in touch many times with people from 2000 and 2004 conventions who are sort of still dealing with the fallout of what happened during those conventions, especially 2004. So I think it'll be interesting to see how 2012 plays out. I also feel very fortunate that our broadcast date on POV, PBS National, is September 6th, which is 5 days before the 10th anniversary of 9/11, and hopefully a time for reflection on, you know, where we've been and where we're going.
Well said, Katie Galloway. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder, and we are thrilled at the release of this important film and just really grateful for your fine work.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.